Today I'm talking to crime writer Jaron Henry, particularly about his most recent book, which was published last year, Pink Tide. And we're meeting on a rather rainy day in Geelong. Thanks very much for your time, Jared.
Thank you for having me. I think it's quite suitable that it's a rainy day like this, because that's the setting in which the book is set.
That's right. It's sort of got a bit of a crimey sort of background, hasn't it?
Yes.
Now, after calling you a crime writer, are you sort of comfortable with that sort of label?
Yeah, I'm pleased that I've reached that point where I consider myself a bona fide crime writer, and I'm happy that people see me that way. Yeah.
So you don't mind the label?
I don't mind the label. Some people have an issue with the idea of crime as a genre, and that it's not as intelligent or whatever as other literary kind of books. But I don't believe that. I think that crime is a vehicle to tell any number of stories, and this one.
I was going to ask you about that particularly. Perhaps I'll sort of just put that bit on hold for the moment, because I just wanted to say that Pink Tide is the third in a series of novels portraying Detective Sergeant Rubens McCauley. Why do you think there's been what seems like there's been quite a renaissance of crime writing in the last few years, and particularly in Australia too? I mean, crime writers seem to be popping up all over the place. Is that something to do with what you're saying as being a vehicle for telling the sort of stories that people have always wanted to tell?
I think that's one reason. I know of a person named Adrian Highland who spent time in an Aboriginal township and compiled a whole heap of notes and journals and documentation, and came back to Melbourne and wanted to somehow put it together into a book, pitched it to the publisher, and the editor said, look, you've got the great, you know, information here, but you've got nothing to tie it all together, you have no vehicle to drive it. And he said, well, what do you want me to do, what do you suggest? And she said, well, why don't you put it into a crime format? Well, I've never written crime before. How do I do that? She said, well, just have somebody killed and have somebody else find out who did it. And he went on to write that book, and it actually sold very well, and he's he never intended to write a crime novel, and ended up doing that. So that worked out quite well for him, and I have taken the same tack. It's a thematic thing. Pink Tide obviously is the themes around forbidden love and homophobia and things like that. Blood Sunset was sort of themed around the issue of child protection and what happens when that goes wrong. And the first one, Headshot, being themed around organised crime and corruption and some things like that. So it's a vehicle to tell any number of stories. And in fact, I think if you can come up with any topic that hasn't been written about in a crime fiction format, then perhaps go ahead and write that book, because it's probably waiting to be read.
So do you think we've been perhaps a little bit sort of stuck up about crime writing in the past, and we put it down the list of types of writing or styles of writing, whereas now it's sort of regaining perhaps the position that it should always have? You have to be able to write character well, you have to be able to give good dialogue, you have to have a good story. I mean, it's all those elements that what we sort of always said a good novel had is now sort of being taken up by crime writers.
Yes, absolutely. I think, and I mean, my age, I wasn't born when a lot of the classics were written, literary classics, but I have seen and been to events and festivals where there has been quite a lot of debate about, well, crime should be stuck separate on its own, and it doesn't need to be part of this literary festival. It was almost, in my opinion, a bit of snobbery and a reluctance from an old-fashioned way of thinking to take on board what they considered pulp fiction, basically. There is an element of crime in itself is very broad. It's no one particular style. There's hard-boiled, there's procedurals, there's quirky and ones that are not as funny crime stories. And so perhaps those ones were not seen as being serious literature, whereas now the ones that take on big issues as a theme, I think get a lot more attention and get taken seriously.
So do you think it's the issues that they deal with more than anything? Because I was going to ask about the issues in Pink Tide. I mean, they're issues about people having preconceptions, prejudices, intolerance, particularly sort of around homophobia. You know, all big issues and sort of still current issues. You feel that crime is the place, appropriate place to explore those sorts of issues too?
I do, and I also think that you know, it's an avenue to tell a story, but it's also an avenue to reflect upon what actually happens in the real world. This is fiction, but this is based on prejudice motivated crime is in fact something very serious, and particularly in doing the research for this, many people who I spoke with, men in their 30s, 40s, 50s even, have said, I knew when I was 9 years old. I knew, but I had to follow the mainstream. And so this, I would like to think, is part of shedding that stigma. And crime is a vehicle for doing that. I'm not trying to stand on a soapbox or anything like that, and that's foolish, I think, of any writer. But yeah, it is a vehicle to really, and I see it as a vehicle to confront serious issues.
I always think too of crime, I mean, the attraction of crime is it's about human psychology, which is what good writing's about anyway. I mean, there's a fascination, whether it's the psychology of the perpetrator or the psychology of the person trying to catch the perpetrator. It's all about human psychology and human beings that we're so fascinated with anyway. So that makes it a selling point, really, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think the notion that you get into the mindset of the characters, that's what a good book should do. Plot, it needs to have a good plot, obviously, but having good characters and getting into their minds and feeling like you know them, even if you've never met those sort of people before, that's one of the big selling points of particularly crime.
Yes.
And,
Just sort of pushing some of the themes that you talk in the novel about, the intolerance, and you make quite a big theme is the using provocation as a defence in crime, particularly sort of the gay provocation, which is very much a current sort of issue, it's very much discussed at the moment. Why did that sort of come into the novel?
It came into the novel as part of the plot, actually, in terms of, this is not a book of who done it, this is a book of why done it. Why did this person do what he did?
Yeah.
And the whole issue of provocation has been on the agenda for a long time for discussion now. I know that I think currently in New South Wales it's being discussed and that it's actually going to be abolished, except in certain circumstances. I think the battered wife syndrome being one of them. I had no idea about that when I was writing it, and sometimes that just happens. Art imitates life.
Yes.
Blood Sunset, for example, I needed to increase the stakes for the characters, so I decided to put a heat wave in there and decided to put some bushfires in there and set it on the same weekend as the St Kilda Festival.
Yeah.
I wrote that in 2007, it was published in 2008, but it was set, pitched forward to February 2009, which was the same weekend as Black Saturday.
That's a bit dangerous.
And so people started to say, do you light these fires? Jokingly. But so it's, they're not a prophecy, they're just
You're just picking up on what's current really in society.
Yeah. And reading a little bit about, where are we headed and what might happen.
Just talking about some of the techniques and that, and it's interesting, I thought that the prologue really tells the reader what the protagonists in the novel sort of find out later. So we know a lot right at the beginning that, a lot of the other characters don't realise it takes them quite a bit of the book It seemed like an unusual technique. Why did you choose that technique?
Okay. Well, firstly, I wanted the prologue to really draw the reader in. Secondly, I was a little bit in two minds because I tested it on a few people and some people said, oh, it could be, depending on who reads it, if a female reads it out loud, it could be a female.
Mm.
Or it could be, but it's obviously a male.
Yeah.
A female wouldn't go into a toilet bowl.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted it to be ambiguous.
Mm.
But at the same time, I didn't want to show who those people were, so their identities are not necessarily revealed.
Mm.
So there is an element of mystery in it.
Yeah.
But it really is about, I'm a big believer in bringing the reader in and grabbing them by the collar and saying, don't give them any excuse to put this book down. The other reason is that with crime books, the convention is that somebody ought to be killed in the first two or three pages, generally speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you don't do that, then you're kind of moving away from conventions and getting yourself into a bit of a risky territory where people might actually put the book down and get bored.
Yeah, yeah. So, a bit of action.
Yeah. And so that, I think the prologue is quite strong.
Mm.
With Headshot, when we re-release it, there is a similar kind of prologue, but doesn't tell a story. It's more of a mindset thing. And throughout the arc of those three books, Macaulay, his mentality changes.
Yeah.
And as you would have picked up in Pink Tide, he's a burnout.
Mm.
He's addicted to prescription medication, and mental illness is another theme that's discussed in there that's also stigmatised.
Yes, yeah. Just before I sort of leave the homophobia theme, it's interesting, I thought, where you sort of, you pick on, I suppose, a fairly macho sort of sport as surfing and football, where you're sort of talking about men coming out. Do you think that's still, it's still a bit of a taboo area? That I know there's been some in the AFL, I think there's actually currently a project on to sort of stamp out homophobia. But do you think that's still a bit of an unknown, or a sort of a taboo area of men coming out? And why is that? I mean, is it because it's such a macho sort of area?
I think I made the point in there about surfing being different, but that you know, people can kind of accept that. With AFL, I do believe, and this is just my own opinion, and it's, I mean, in the whole entire history of the sport, not one person has come out, even after having retired. Now, one, you look at the census data, one in 11 people in Australia tick the box to say that they are gay, lesbian, or transsexual, GLBTI. And yet, in the entire history of AFL, not one person has come out. And I find that hard to believe. In other football codes, it has. And so I think that there's still a lot of bigotry out there. You know, I know people who play football, local leagues and things like that, and they use, you know, disparaging language all the time. And they've read the book, and some of them said, look, you know, I'm not a fan of those people, Gerard, but I really did like the book. And so I'm hoping that it does slowly throw another coal in the fire of burning out that stigma, but I do believe it's there. The AFL will have a long way to go, I believe.
Just sort of talking particularly about the location of the novel, your first two novels were set pretty much in Melbourne, and part of this novel is in Melbourne too, but a lot of it's sort of set not too far away from where we're talking today, down the Great Ocean Road, particularly in a place called Jut Rock. I was sort of wondering why you sort of moved from Melbourne to take on a new location.
Okay, so with the two preliminary books, not that they can't be read as standalone novels, but the journey in the arc from a character, Macaulay, he really is quite burnt out by the time he gets to the end of Blood Sunset, and him and his wife kind of make a pact that they're going to move out of Melbourne and rent the apartments out and move. So I chose this location because, one, I'm familiar with it, two, it is a fictitious town, so I'm not offending anybody in particular. I do know that there's a conundrum between locals who live off the tourism trade, but at the same time are frustrated that they have to accept that, and I know that there has been some clashes over that in the past.
And Daylesford was a good example. Yes.
Well, that's effectively, I think, what it's referred to in the book is Daylesford on the beach.
That's right.
And you know, Daylesford's a beautiful town, and the point is made quite clearly in there, you know, that the, some locals will be happy to tolerate the money coming in and be happy to tolerate you know, certain things, but it reaches a point, it's a bubbling point, that underlying bigotry is still there. You know, going back just a few steps, some of the people who I spoke with in the research for this have told me that none of their family speak to them anymore, you know, when they came out. They had kids, they got married, and they bought houses, and then when they were in their late 30s or whatever, they just couldn't hack it anymore. Instead of going to toilet blocks and things like that and meeting in parks, they just said to the family, look, this is who I am. And everyone says, oh, he turned gay. No, he didn't turn, he always was, it's just society didn't kind of accept it. So that's one area that I wanted to take on, and another was the conundrum of you know, country life and city life, and the clashes between city and bush politically as well as socially. But the mental illness thing too.
Yes,
there's a stigma attached to that. So I was kind of trying to serve a number of purposes without standing on a soapbox.
You do sort of seem to be interested in outsiders. I mean, in a way, sort of, Rubens is a bit of an outsider too, as well as, you know, those other characters. And even, is it Pai Horn?
Yes.
Who's the only Asian member in police in the South West, I think. So you sort of, there's quite an interest there, a fascination with the outsider.
Yes.
People perhaps don't quite, or don't, or think they don't quite fit into the norm. Is that right?
Yeah, and that was quite deliberate. So that everybody kind of in the story is forbidden in some way. You know, his friend Cassie is, you know, her life is up or down. His wife is unhappy. You know, no one in the story is really happy. They're all kind of outsiders, even though they're living in this one community. And the notion of living in a small community where you know everybody and it's friendly and all of that, I wanted to sort of talk about or touch on the positives of that, but also how it can go wrong.
Had you had experience yourself in that sort of community?
Our family have a house in Anglesey, and we grew up in a suburban area where everybody knew each other in the street. And so it was kind of like a little bit a neighbour's Ramsey Street type scenario. And yes, it was nice, it had its benefits, but it also meant that everybody knew everyone else's business. So privacy was an issue sometimes, and gossip and things like that.
I think you pick up on that very clearly.
So you throw into that a mix of, you know, well, a superstar, you know, and then a sports person, and you throw all these other big chunks into the fire, and it starts to really burn.
Makes for an interesting story. You were telling me sort of before we started the formal interview about that these three novels are coming out as a trilogy. Can you say a little bit about that? And that meant a little bit of rewriting on your part?
Yes. Well, Headshot I wrote initially back in 2004, and it was published in 2005. So a lot's happened since then, and when I look back, I sort of cringe a little bit when I read the old version. You know, I've learned a lot in the time being, and it would—it's not very often that you get the chance to do something your first time again. So the opportunity to do that was floated by the publisher, Arcadia, and so I suggested, yes, well, I'll rewrite it then in first person, so that it matches the style. And if we have three covers that are kind of a similar concept, That will then complete the arc. In fact, it's almost like a three-act play.
Yeah.
You know, we have the beginning of this person's, dive into his career, and then the second one is he does quite well, and then the third one is he's a burnout and looking at work cover.
So it's
having the chance to rewrite Headshot and hopefully have that re-released scheduled for August would be good, and hopefully people are happy with the revamped and revised version.
I wonder why you went sort of from, say, third person in the beginning and then you went to first person for the other two. Why do you think you made that switch of voice?
Blood Sunset was written in the third person to begin with.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I asked myself, what if, and that's what, as a writing technique, if I have writer's block, I think something's not strong here, something's not working. I said, what if I do this? What would it mean? So I said, well, what if I put a heat wave in there? What will that mean? It changes everything. All of a sudden, everybody's behaving differently. We've got bushfires going up, people looting, we're running out of water, people throwing babies off bridges, all this sort of thing. Let's take it a bit further. What if I put it in first person? That makes it more like an autobiography. It makes it more real. And that appeals to a different type of reader. A lot of, particularly men, won't read fiction. And they'll say to me, I don't read fiction, Jared. If I want to read something, I will read something real, like Shane Warne's autobiography or something like that. And that's fair enough. That's, everyone's entitled to that. What I try and do is say, well, if I can get those people to read my books and actually engage and enjoy them, then I've achieved a pretty good goal there, which is why I prefer the first person in that sense. Headshot does have other couple of characters in it that have a point of view, and they are told in the third person. So it's a bit of a mixture with that one, so we'll see how we go.
We're also sort of talking before the official interview too about your fixation, which is a bit like my fixation with words and choice of words and that. Where does that come from for you? Why do they fascinate you so much? Why do you sort of get so worked up about words and word choice and writing sentences, and where did that start?
Well, sentence structure, I think, is important, and I do attribute a lot of that to my father when he was alive, with assignments and things like that. He'd read my essays and he'd go through and say, you could write a lot more and get a lot more content and people would understand it more if only you wrote this differently. And so he would go through and cross out certain words and rewrite a sentence and say, do that the whole way through. And I started to do that, and applying that in also, with books and with the professional world, I think is very important. I've never been a believer in using big long words just for the sake of sounding intelligent, or I'd rather have a short, snappy sentence. Every word should pull its weight. That's my belief. I work under the assumption that people are time poor. They've got iPods, they've got iPhones, they've got music, they've got interviews, they've got other work to do, magazines, free newspapers. They're studying. Why do they want to read my book? So why would I give them a reason to put it down? Every word has to pull its weight. And I think that's the same in the professional, if I was writing for a newspaper, I do a blog every week. And in that blog, I make sure that, it's under 1,500 words, and that's every word. I'm not just writing that waffle for nothing.
I wonder where your father got that interest in words from then. Was he always like that?
No, he was more of a mathematics man, actually, but he had a very strong fixation with wanting to teach myself and my brother things as a father. So when I came to him for emotional advice, he had 20 cents in the bank account. But if I came to him with practical advice, he was full of generosity and plenty of time. And him being away a lot, he was a pilot. I guess maybe his part of making up for that was, well, son, show me your homework. And, And he appreciated me asking him.
So
I did a few short stories in high school and got some quite good, you know, top marks for those. And that then sort of, you know, gave me the impetus to, okay, I went to uni, university, and I found that the academic language I couldn't understand it. It was like another language, and it didn't make sense, and some of it was boring. So I started reading a lot of crime books, true crime stories, and I found those to be far more fascinating. So that I learnt more from that about crime and criminology than I did the actual criminology honours degree. So starting in the workforce, a similar thing took place. I was in a sort of low-level clerical kind of role in the justice system. I was bored with that, so I wanted to write a book. So I wrote the blurb, what you would consider to be back page, headshot. I showed it to my wife at the time, and she said, it sounds good. Is that a book you're going to buy? And I said, nah, it's a book I'm going to write. And she said, oh, bullshit. I said, okay, well, now I have to write it. So 5 years.
Challenge.
So I was a little bit pig-headed like that, I think, and perfectionist as well, which is a problem sometimes in any art form, whether you're a musician or an artist or you know, a wordsmith or whatever. But perfectionism.
That's probably not a bad thing to have, isn't it? Look, I can't let you go without just finally, just you were talking about the trilogy and about Ruben's sort of finishing up a bit washed out. Is that the end of Ruben's? I had the feeling at the end of Pink Tide, like, yeah, there could have been a bit more to come. I had to turn the page, there would have been another bit of the story there.
I've left it open. I have left it open. Yes, it's a trilogy at this point in time. I'm in the point of possibly looking at working on something else. Which I'm not going to talk too much about at this stage, it's a little bit sensitive. But for him to come back now, I would need to really think about how he would come back from all of that. You know, being truthful to not just the genre, but to human nature. How can somebody go through all of that? I mean, the scene where he's at the doctor's surgery. He talks to Graham Barlow or whatever the doctor. And the doctor just lists everything that's happened to him. And it's like, well, you're running on empty. You've got nothing left.
Yeah.
If you don't stop, you're looking at section 10, you know, psych ward. So I didn't want that to happen to him. So at the end, and also leaving it open with his relationships and things like that, kind of, people always ask me that. I was like, well, we just have to wait and see.
We don't know. Well, on that tantalising note, perhaps we'll just leave it there. Jared, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you.